It's been a while because of various and sundry factors, but we have the opportunity to continue. To me, this is such an important study. It's important for many reasons. It's important because there's so much false teaching on Matthew 24. The vast majority of people claiming to be Christians say that this chapter is talking about the second and final coming of Christ, and it's not. At least the first half or so of the chapter is not. It's important from the standpoint of God's dealing with nations, especially the nation he especially chose, Israel. He had been long-suffering with these people for over 1,500 years. He sent them prophet after prophet. He warned them and warned them and warned them. And finally, his long-suffering ran out. And Jesus addresses that in the last part of chapter 23. In verse 37, O Jerusalem, Jerusalem, the one who kills the prophets and stones those who are sent to her, how often I wanted to gather your children together as she gathers her chicks under her wings, but you were not willing. See, your house is left unto you desolate. For I say to you, you shall see me no more till you say, blessed is he who comes in the name of the Lord. So as we continue our study, we want to pick up, get the right button here. We want to pick up in Matthew 24, verses 21 and 22. Jesus tells us that the scope of the devastation that's going to take place at the destruction of Jerusalem is going to be terrible and unprecedented. This time of tribulation is unparalleled in Jewish history and probably in the history of mankind. It's amazing to me that this is not something that's studied quite often in our history classes in school. I know why it's not, because it has something to do with the Bible, but there is so much good, verifiable history that support the fact that these events actually took place. As we think about the time of tribulation, we need to remember that this whole region of Judea at this time in history is engulfed in two wars. It's engulfed in the war with the Romans, and it's engulfed in civil war. So in verses 21 and 22, Jesus says, for then, when this happens, shall be great tribulation, such as was not since the beginning of the world to this time, no, nor ever shall be. And except those days should be shortened, there should be no flesh be saved. But for the elect's sake, those days shall be shortened. I'm going to read quite a bit of material this evening, but I think that's the best way to understand the scope and the terribleness of this destruction. This is from a book by a man named Horford. He says that while Jerusalem was a prey to these ferocious and devouring factions, that's the factions of the Jews, every part of Judea was scourged and laid waste by bands of robbers and murderers who plundered the towns and in cases of resistance slew the inhabitants, not sparing either women or children. Simon, son of Gioras, the commander of one of these bands, at the head of 40,000 bandits, the big band of bandits that were roaming the countryside, having with some difficulty entered Jerusalem, gave birth to a third faction of the Jews, and the flame of civil discord blazed out again with still more destructive fury. The three factions, rendered frantic by drunkenness, rage, and desperation, trampling on heaps of slain bodies, fought against each other with brutal savageness and madness. The dead bodies of priests and worshipers, both natives and foreigners. You have to remember that when this first began, it was the Passover. So Jerusalem was swelled with visitors for that. Okay, The dead bodies of priests and worshipers, both natives and foreigners, were heaped together, and a lake of blood stagnated in the sacred courts. John of Jiskala, who headed one of the factions, burned storehouses full of provisions. And Simon, his great antagonist, who headed another of these factions, soon afterwards followed his example. Thus, they cut the very sinews of their own strength. At this critical and alarming conjuncture, intelligence arrived that the Roman army was watching the city. They cut off their nose despite their face. According to what I can read, they had over 20 months of provisions that would have sustained the city, but they burned all of these provisions. Providence? Okay, there were several elements that I believe shows this is obviously providential in nature. First, the Jews repelled the first Roman legions that approached the city. And this resulted in a short suspension of the hostilities between the Jews and the Romans. But the Jews were so stiff-necked in nature, it gave them false hope that God was on their side. We won the first battle, so God's on our side, and we're going to prevail. So few, if any, of the Jews took advantage of the situation and fled the city. Now remember, that's what Jesus had told them to do. Furthermore, there's irony involved here. According to Josephus, the day on which Titus encompassed Jerusalem was the feast of the Passover. And it is deserving of the very particular attention of the reader that this was the anniversary of that memorable period in which the Jews crucified their Messiah. Providence is at work. This fact caused the population of Jerusalem to be swollen due to the thousands of pilgrims who came to observe the Passover. It had been like the Passover and Pentecost that we read about in Acts chapters 1 and 2. Given the population of Jerusalem was swollen due to the Passover, the Lord's words in Luke 21:21 are quite appropriate. And there he said, "Then let those who are in Judea flee to the mountains. Let those who are in the midst of her depart. And let not those who are in the country enter her." Over and over, God is giving them opportunity to flee this destruction, but unfortunately, the vast majority did not take advantage. Once the siege began, there was no escape from the city. Again, according to Josephus, a ceaseless cry of combatants was heard day and night, and yet the lamentations of mourners were still more dreadful. You can imagine this city encompassed by the Romans. Internally, they're killing one another in the civil war, and the cries of the people are going out. Okay, so we need to remember that simultaneously with the Roman war, there's this civil war taking place. There's two wars. And these various factions of the Jews were fighting one another as the Romans are preparing to besiege the city. Factions known as the Zealots and the Sicarii were engaged in constant political assassinations. If there was even a hint that you might be supporting the Romans, it was very likely you were going to be assassinated on the streets of Jerusalem. And that they also had this great zeal, but it worked to their disadvantage. Remember 2 Thessalonians 2, 10 and 11. God will allow us to be deluded by a lie if we don't love the truth. And that was certainly taking place here because they were holding out, believing that God was on their side and would deliver them. But that was not the case. They didn't listen to the Lord as they should have. And again, these food stores were great and they were burned by these factions of the Jews. They burned them with the idea that it would increase everybody's fervor to pull together and fight the Romans, but it turned and backfired on them big time. So once the Romans had consolidated their defense or surrounded the city and so forth, a terrible famine broke out and gripped the city. Impelled, according to Josephus, impelled by the cravings of hunger, they snatched the staff of life out of each other's hands. So they became totally desperate due to the famine that now grips the city. And people were dying by the thousands every day, either through the fighting or through the famine and pestilence that naturally comes with the famine. While the city was in this dismal situation, a Jew named Manaus fled to Titus and informed him that from the beginning of the siege, which was on April 14th, to the 1st of July, 115,880 dead bodies had been carried out through the one gate which he had guarded. Can you imagine the carnage that took place? This dreadful scourge at length drove multitudes of the Jews out of the city into the enemy's camp, where the Romans crucified them in such numbers that, as Josephus relates, space was wanting for the crosses and crosses for the captives. And it having been discovered that some of them had swallowed gold, the Arabs and Syrians who were incorporated in the Roman army, impelled by avarice with unexampled cruelty, ripped open 2,000 of the deserters in one night. Imagine that scene. Titus, touched by these calamities in person, entreated the Jews to surrender, but they answered him with revilings. Exasperated by their obstinacy and insolence, he now resolved to surround the city by a circumvallation. He builds a siege berm around the city of 39 furlongs in length. He built this 5-mile berm of earth around the city and strengthened it with 13 towers, which with astonishing activity was effected by the soldiers in 3 days. So thousands upon thousands of these Roman soldiers build this siege wall around Jerusalem. And again, that's according to prophecy. For the day shall come upon thee that thine enemies shall cast a trench about thee and compass thee round and keep thee on every side. On more than one occasion, Titus, the Roman general, took pity on the city and on the awfulness of the siege and offered terms of surrender. But each time he was rebuffed by the Jews. He wanted to end the suffering and the slaughter, but they wouldn't have it. On behalf of Titus, Josephus himself exhorted the Jews to surrender. Of course, he was a Jew. In fact, he was a zealot. He was captured by the Romans, and for some reason, Titus kind of took a shine to Josephus, found out he was a learned man, and appointed him the historian. He actually commissioned him to record all of this history. He wanted a history that was written by a Jew so people would believe what was taking place. But they even refused to hear Josephus. Soon after, several respectable individuals deserted to the Romans and assured Titus that the whole number of the poor who had been cast out at the different gates was not less than 600,000. The reports of these calamities excited pity in the Romans, and in a particular manner affected Titus, who, while surveying the immense number of dead bodies which were piled up under the walls, raised his hands towards heaven, and, appealing to the Almighty, solemnly protested that he had not been the cause of these deplorable calamities, which indeed the Jews, by their unexampled wickedness, rebellion, and obstinacy, had brought upon their own heads. They were killing themselves. Okay, again, this famine that beset Jerusalem was beyond our imagination. The famine compelled the Jews to eat their belts, their sandals, the skins of their shields, dried grass, and even manure. In the depth of this horrible extremity, a Jewess of noble family, urged by the intolerable cravings of hunger, slew her infant son or child and prepared it for a meal. and had actually eaten one half thereof when the soldiers, allured by the smell of food, threatened her with instant death if she used to reveal it. Intimidated by this menace, she immediately produced the remains of her son, which petrified them with horror. At the recital of this melancholy and affecting occurrence, the whole city stood aghast and poured forth their congratulations on those whom death had hurried away from such heartrending scenes. This, by the way, is according to prophecy in the Old Testament. Remember, just as Moses was passing away from the scene, he told them, this is what happens. These are the blessings if you serve God. These are the cursings if you do not. And one of them is here in Deuteronomy 30 or 28, beginning in verse 56. It says, the tender and delicate woman among you, which would not adventure to set the sole of her foot upon the ground for delicateness and tenderness. Her eye shall be evil toward the husband of her bosom, and toward her son, and toward her daughter, and toward her young one that cometh out from between her feet, and toward her children which she shall bear. For she shall eat them for want of all things secretly in the siege and straitness, wherewith thine enemy shall distress thee in thy gates. 1,500-year-old prophecy coming to fruition. So the state of the famine became so great that mothers ate their own children. Josephus himself declares that if there had not been many credible witnesses of this fact, that women were eating their own children, he would not have recorded it. Because, as he remarks, such a shocking violation of nature, never having been perpetrated by any Greek or barbarian, the insertion of it might have diminished the credibility of his history. He was worried about that he would be believed, but it was the truth. So many Jews tried to sneak out of the city, but they were intercepted by the Romans, and they were executed. Most were executed by crucifixion. In the biography, which is the biography of Jerusalem, the writer records this. He says, thousands of bodies putrefied in the sun, packs of wild dogs and jackals feasted on human flesh, and the stench was unbearable. Imagine over 115,000 dead people taken out of one gate. There, how would you even approach bearing such a number? Titus ordered all prisoners and defectors to be crucified. He finally lost his patience. 500 Jews were crucified each day on the Mount of Olives, such that there were barely any trees remaining to use as a crucifix. Now, I can't verify this 100%, but I know I read in some place, and I just couldn't track it down, that said that all of the trees within a 13-mile radius of Jerusalem were cut down by the Romans, either for their siege engines or to crucify these people, and they still didn't have enough crosses to crucify all of the people. There was a backlog, you might say, a terrible, terrible thought. Well, eventually, the Romans breached the walls of the temple complex and gained control of the great Tower of Antonia. If you remember, several weeks ago, we talked about the Tower of Antonia. And then they began advancing towards the temple itself. Titus, the Roman general, he was determined to spare the temple. He wanted to keep the temple as an ornament of the Roman Empire. And if you remember our discussion of the temple, how grand and great it was. So you can imagine he didn't want to destroy that. But on the 10th of August, emphatically called a day of vengeance in Luke 21, 22, the temple, which ironically was the day the temple was destroyed back in 587 by the Babylonians. It was on that day that a Roman soldier threw a firebrand of some sort through one of the windows of the temple. Imagine all of this going on, and people are screaming and carrying on, and the Titus had issued this order not for the temple not to be destroyed, but it couldn't be heard because of all this that was going on. Well, so the temple caught on fire, and both the Jews and the Romans tried to put the fire out, but were unable to do that. So providence held sway over the whole affair. The Jews and the Romans tried to extinguish the fire, but to no success. Titus called for his soldiers to put out the fire, but again, the din of battle prevented them from hearing these orders, so they weren't carried out. After the destruction of the temple, Titus once again offered to spare the lives of the rebels if they would put down their arms, but they refused again and again and again. So he was resolved to grant no pardons and continue until the entire city had been totally destroyed. So one thing that we forget is that there was a great loss of life on the Roman side of this affair, as there was on the Jewish side. And the more Roman soldiers that died, you can imagine what the other soldiers, how they began to behave. They were in no mood to extend mercy when their comrades are being killed in great numbers. It says, multitudes of the dead and dying were heaped around about the altar to which they had formerly fled for protection, while the steps that led from it into the outer court, this is the temple, were literally deluged with blood. The Romans, exasperated to the highest pitch against the Jews, seized every person whom they could find, and without the least regard to sex, age, or quality, first plundered and then slew them. The old and the young, the common people and the priests, those who surrendered and those who resisted, were equally involved in this horrible and indiscriminate carnage. Meanwhile, the temple continued burning at length. Vast as was its size, the flames completely enveloped the whole building, which from the extent of the conflagration impressed the distant spectator with an idea that the whole city was on fire. The tumult and disorder which ensued upon this event, it is impossible, according to Josephus, for language to describe. The Roman legions made the most horrid outcries. The rebels, finding themselves exposed to the fury of both the fire and the sword, screamed dreadfully, while the unhappy people who were pent up between the enemy and the flames deplored their situation in the most pitiable complaints. Those on the hill and those in the city seemed mutually to return the groans of each other. Such as were expiring through the famine were revived by this hideous scene and seemed to acquire new spirits to deplore their misfortunes. The lamentations from the city were re-echoed from the adjacent mountains and places beyond Jordan. The flames which enveloped the temple were so violent and impetuous that the lofty hill on which it stood appeared, even from its deep foundations, as one large body of fire. The blood of the sufferers flowed in proportion to the rage of this destructive element, and the number of the slain exceeded all calculation. The ground could not be seen for the dead bodies, over which the Romans trampled in pursuit of the fugitives, while the crackling noise of the devouring flames mingled with the clamor of arms. The groans of the dying and the shrieks of despair augmented the tremendous horror of a scene to which the pages of history can furnish no parallel. One little sidelight, sort of, is, remember Jesus said not one stone would be left upon another. Well, marble, according to what I can read, crumbles when it gets over 850 degrees, and this fire was of that nature. So the walls of the temple literally crumbled. So the Romans killed nearly every soul in the city. Finally, their bloodlust was satiated, and they took prisoners and sold them as slaves. There were many sold to sell, but there were few buyers. Therefore, they were sold next to nothing. And this fulfills another prophecy in Deuteronomy 28. It says that the Lord will take you back to Egypt in ships, by the way of which I said to you, you shall never see it again. And there you shall be offered for sale to your enemies as male and female slaves, but no one will buy you. So they were sold for nearly nothing. So the Romans burned, pillaged, and broke down the remaining walls. Some of the Jews sought refuge in the city's subterranean passageways. No less than 2,000 dead bodies were found down in these passageways. So no matter what they tried to do to get away from it, they couldn't get away. They ranged through the streets with drawn swords in their hands. That's the Romans, murdering every Jew whom they met without distinction, until at length the bodies of the dead choked up all the alleys and narrow passageways, while their blood literally flowed down the channels of the city streets. The siege lasted nearly 5 months, April 14th to September 8th, 70 AD. Titus attributed his success to divine intervention. I'd have to agree with that. Again, according to Josephus, before their final demolition, however, Titus took a survey of the city and its fortifications, and while contemplating their impregnable strength, could not help ascribing his success to the peculiar interposition of the Almighty himself. Had not God himself, exclaimed he, aided our operations and driven the Jews from their fortresses, it would have been absolutely impossible to have taken them. For what could men and the force of engines have done against such towers as these? After this, he commanded that the city should be cut down to its foundations, excepting only the three lofty towers, and he names them here, which he allowed as evidence of its strength and as trophies for his victory. There was left standing also a small part of the western wall as a rampart for a garrison to keep the surrounding country in subjection. And that western wall is what exists today, called the Wailing Wall, and that's where the Jews go and say prayers and so forth. Any survivors were enslaved by the Romans. The tallest and most beautiful youths, together with several Jewish nobles, were reserved by Titus to grace his triumphal entry into Rome. After this selection, all above the age of 17 were sent in chains into Egypt to be employed there as slaves or distributed throughout the empire to be sacrificed as gladiators in the amphitheaters, while those who were under this age were exposed to sale. Josephus says that about 11,000 of the captives perished in the hands of the Romans through starvation. He also says of the Jews destroyed during the siege, Josephus reckons not less than 1,100,000, to which must be added more than 237,000 who perished in other places in Judea, and innumerable multitudes who perished in other places, and innumerable multitudes who were swept away by famine and pestilence, of which no calculation could be made. Of the captives, the whole number was about 97,000. So there are 1.1 million people in the city. 1 million of them died. Out in the countryside, there are hundreds of thousands that couldn't even be counted that also perished in this war. So the Lord's prophecies were dramatically fulfilled. Again, in executing the command of Titus relative to the demolition of Jerusalem, the Roman soldiers not only threw down the buildings, but even dug up the foundations and so completely leveled the whole circuit of the city that a stranger would scarcely have known that it had ever been inhabited by human beings. And again, this is something that Jesus foretold. He says, "And shall lay thee even with the ground, and thy children within thee, and they shall not leave in thee one stone upon another, because thou knewest not the time of thy visitation." Concerning the temple, our Lord had foretold, particularly, that notwithstanding their wonderful dimensions, there should not be left one stone upon another that should not be thrown down. And accordingly, it is recorded in the Talmud and by other Jewish sources and by Roman sources that the captain of the army of Titus absolutely plowed up the foundations of the temple with a plowshare. now also was literally fulfilled that what the prophet Micah said, therefore shall Zion, for your sakes, that's for their wickedness, be plowed as a field, and Jerusalem shall become heaps, and the mountain of the Lord's house as the high places of the forest. They knew there was all of this gold in the temple. Much of it had melted during this great fire, and that's why they plowed that area to get that gold. The killing wasn't over. After the destruction of Jerusalem, 1,700 Jews who surrendered at another place there in Judea were slain. And this happened in several places. Titus marched off to Caesarea. Remember, that's on the seacoast. His brother, and celebrated his brother Domitian's birthday by killing over 2,500 Jews in the arena. So they had a big party, I guess you could say, a death party. About 960 Jews committed mass suicide at Masada. The rich territory of Judea had been reduced to a desolate wasteland. Isaiah 6, verses 11 and 12 say, then I said, Lord, how long? And he answered, until the cities are laid waste and without inhabitant. The houses are without a man. The land is utterly desolate. The Lord has removed men far away, and the forsaken places are many in the midst of the land. After the aftermath of this is, by the time it all ended, 1 million Jews had fallen by the edge of the sword. 100,000 had been led away captive. I tried to, I'm kind of a student of history, tried to find another event in history that might even come close to paralleling this. The scope of the devastation is unimaginable. And the only catastrophe that I could come up with that even came close to this, and I think still falls short, was the Battle of Stalingrad in World War II. That was the single worst battle insofar as the loss of life was concerned that occurred in World War II. In fact, if you study World War II history, in my mind, it's unequivocal that the Battle of Stalingrad was the turning point in the war in Europe. From that point forward, Hitler and his armies never made an offensive move in the east. They did in the west at the Battle of the Bulge, but never again in the east. They were constantly on the run after that. That battle began with 200,000 soldiers on each side. That's big enough in itself, but it grew to 1 million soldiers on each side before it ended. It too lasted about 5 months, just like the destruction of Jerusalem. Total dead was 765,000. 250,000 dead Nazi soldiers, 40,000 dead civilians, 475,000 dead Soviet soldiers. But it's still, even that battle falls short of what happened in Jerusalem in 70 AD. Josephus said, if the misfortunes of all nations from the beginning of the world were compared with those which befell the Jews, they would appear far less in comparison. No other city ever suffered such things, as no other generation from the beginning of the world ever more fruitful in wickedness. And again, the Lord said, for these be the days of vengeance, that all things which are written may be fulfilled. But woe unto them that are with child, and to them that give suck in those days. For there shall be great distress in the land, and wrath upon this people. And they shall fall by the edge of the sword, and shall be led away captive into all nations. And Jerusalem shall be trodden down of the Gentiles until the time of the Gentiles be fulfilled. It's a pretty heart-rending situation when you get into these details. We need to remember that God judges people. He will judge all of us at the end. Will all appear before the judgment seat of Christ. And God judges nations. The Old Testament is literally full of God's judgment of the nations, and he ultimately judged his own nation for their wickedness. No one escapes the judgment of God. Remember what the Hebrew writer said, it's a fearful thing to fall into the hands of the living God. If you're here tonight and you're not a Christian or you're not a faithful Christian, it is a fearful thing to fall into the hands of the living God. Don't let that happen to you. We want to encourage you to obey the Lord as we stand and sing the song of invitation.
Sinners, Jesus.